I mean, this is not NATO Article 5 that we're talking about here. Yes, Hezbollah opened the support front. Indisputably, it's been valuable in a number of respects. But Hezbollah would only engage in a full-scale war with Israel if it determines that that is in the interests of Hezbollah and Lebanon.
And do you think ultimately Hezbollah considers it to be in the interests of Hezbollah and Lebanon to launch a full-scale assault on Israel?
Well, if it did, it would have already happened. And quite clearly at this point in time, that is not the position of the Hezbollah leadership. But equally, there could be circumstances in which that assessment changes. And that would be primarily in response to an Israeli. My impression is that Hezbollah is prepared for war. Hezbollah has not taken a decision for war, but it has also taken a decision that it will not shrink from Israeli challenges, even at the risk of war. In other words, Israel assassinated its senior military commander, Fuad Shukr, in Beirut on July 31st. Hezbollah took a decision that it needed to launch a significant response to that attack and was determined to do so, even if the consequence was a war that it otherwise did not want.
And has it done that?
I think...
It fired, 100 Katyusha rockets and sent off a whole bunch of drones. I don't know, 90% of them were shot down. The Israelis say that it was virtually no damage was incurred.
Well,
a third of Hezbollah assets were destroyed. Hezbollah says, Nasrallah says, oh, this is all a lie. This is not true. We struck our targets and...
Well, I don't want to give a clear answer to that because I don't know. What I will say is that I tend not to believe the Israeli narrative that the sum total of damage caused by Hezbollah's strikes was two wounded chickens. Israel claims that it engaged in a preemptive strike on southern Lebanon that foiled an anticipated Hezbollah attack and destroyed, I think, between 1,000 and 6,000 missiles in the process. I don't really buy that. Hezbollah claims that what we saw was conforms to its initial plans, which was to launch 300 Katyusha rockets at Israel, not for the purpose of causing damage, but primarily in order to overwhelm Israel's air defenses, and that in doing so, that enabled it to fire dozens of drones that hit the intended target, which was the headquarters of Unit 8200 of Israeli military intelligence.
And did they hit it?
I have not seen evidence that they have, and I have not seen evidence that they haven't. So I think the jury is still out on that. I will say two things. Number one is that I don't think that the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, would have given an extensive address about this attack on the day it occurred if he had conclusive information that the attack had failed. I think he would have understood that would have been too serious a blow to his and his movement's credibility. At the same time, if you listen carefully to what he said, he did say that their initial indications are that the attack was a success, but that they will be evaluating what happened, and if it hasn't achieved its intended objectives, they reserve the right to carry out further attacks. Now, that could be understood in two ways. One is that they're not sure that they hit the intended target, and the other, by intended objective, meaning that they have successfully deterred Israel. So again, given everything we know and given everything we don't know, I don't think we're in a position to conclude that the attack was a success, and I also don't think we're in a position to conclude that the attack was a failure.
And Iran has not yet responded to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh.
Yes.
In the capital, Tehran, in the midst of a presidential inauguration ceremony. murdered by an Israeli missile or some object in his Revolutionary Guard hotel room.
Yes.
And Iran has done nothing.
Well, again...
And it seems to me that Israel has unlimited capacity to assault Lebanon and Syria and Iran.
Well, again, this
and gets... there isn't any reciprocation, or there's only the slightest level of reciprocation. I mean, there isn't a day or night when Lebanese airspace isn't being violated by Israeli aircraft and drones.
Well, this gets back to my earlier point that we need to understand the axis of resistance as a coalition of converging interests rather than a formal alliance, which also means that each of the members of this coalition acts primarily in furtherance of its own interests rather than on the basis of a, collective plan of action, if you will.
And generally speaking, what are their interests? If you look at the axis of resistance,
well, if I could just continue.
Hezbollah and Iran, what's their objective? What's their ultimate aim?
Well,
they certainly don't want to get into a full-scale war with Israel because they'll get annihilated.
But I just want to continue on the issue of Iran. Iran did launch a direct attack on Israel in April, but if you look at the context of that attack, it was in direct response to an Israeli bombing of Iran's diplomatic embassy complex in Damascus, in the Syrian capital Damascus, rather than in response to any new Israeli outrage in the Gaza Strip. Proving again my point, I think, that each of these Axis of Resistance members acts primarily in its own interests. Now, you've said Iran hasn't responded to Israel's assassination of Haniyeh and the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in the Iranian capital Tehran on August 1st. That's true. I wouldn't conclude that they're not going to respond, and I also wouldn't conclude that they're going to respond by launching a more significant direct attack on Israel as they did in April. It's entirely possible that the Iranian leadership, for example, will conclude that the best and most appropriate response to this assassination and to ensure future deterrence of Israel would be, for example, to cross the nuclear weapons threshold. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that is going to be Iranian response, particularly because in recent months they've come closer to a direct confrontation with the U.S. than at any time in the last few years. And perhaps also in their memory was the extraordinary hostility of the Trump administration to Iran, and from their point of view, the real possibility that he may want once again be in the White House next year. So this would be hitting several birds with one stone, if you will. But in terms of, again, it's a coalition that has a common agenda and common interests.
What do you see as their ultimate aim and their strategy?
I think what ties them together is a collective determination to see reduced U.S. and Israeli influence in the Middle East, whether directly or indirectly. I don't think, they have this master plan to transform the Middle East into a Shiite caliphate or whatever you want to call it. That's not their agenda. I think what the bond between them is a shared opposition to U.S. and Israeli influence in the region, and they do, I think, coordinate to seek to reduce that influence. But again, it's not a formal alliance, which explains why it doesn't behave as one.
You are listening to an extended conversation about Palestine, Israel, and the Middle East with Dutch-Palestinian commentator Muin Rabbani. How about international law, I asked Rabbani. In a pair of groundbreaking rulings, the International Court of Justice in The Hague has declared Israel's assault on Gaza to be plausibly genocidal and its 57-year occupation of Palestine definitively illegal. Across town, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has applied for arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister Yoav Gallant. The court's pretrial chamber is now poised to approve those arrest warrants. What role do these developments play in bringing about justice and peace in Palestine, Israel? I asked Muin Rabbani. Last question, virtually the last question. What role does the International Court of Justice, do the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, two totally different courts, play in bringing about a resolution to this situation, to this conflict? Do they play a role?
I think they play a role, and I think they play an important role, but I also think it's important not to have any illusions about their role. We're not dealing with a national criminal court where, you know, you appear before a judge because you've, you know, murdered someone or engaged in a bank robbery and you're convicted and you go immediately from the courthouse to a prison. That's not how these institutions work. They have their ability to enforce their rulings is entirely dependent on the actions of others beyond their control. Having said that, I think, for example, the January ruling by the International Court of Justice that Israel is plausibly committing genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip was of enormous political significance. I think its more recent advisory opinion that the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, including East Jerusalem, is illegitimate and illegal and unlawful, again, is of enormous political significance. I mean, if you take, again, to revert to South Africa, it took years for the International Court of Justice to finally issue a similar ruling against the South African occupation of Namibia. I think it was in 1971 that it finally issued that ruling. Did that end the South African occupation of Namibia? It did nothing of the sort. Did it change anything on the ground within the first decade? It changed absolutely nothing. But it was an important building block, I think, in dismantling the white minority regime in South Africa, and ultimately in achieving the freedom and independence of Namibia. So if you look at this particular case, you know, Israel, of course, was established in 1948 in the immediate aftermath of the German Holocaust during World War II. And I think for many people, particularly in Europe, there's always been, you know, they've had a tendency to look at Israel through the perspective of the Holocaust. In other words, they tend to look at Israel not as, how should I put this, not as the product of developments in the Middle East, not as an outgrowth of the European colonial history, but they tend to see it from the vantage point of Europe's persecution of the Jews, culminating in the Holocaust. Well, if that's how you look at Israel, it's almost it becomes very difficult for you to then also see Israel as an oppressor. For then also, you know, if you look at Israel as kind of the how should you put it, as reparations for the ultimate victims of European history, then it becomes very, very difficult to conceive of the Palestinians as victims of a European colonial venture that is Israel. And to see now Israel plausibly accused of genocide by the International Court of Justice is, in my view, a political game changer, because now, you know, people will look at Israel and have the ability to judge it on the basis of what it actually does rather than on the basis of what they think it is. And that's hugely significant. Secondly, the advisory opinion, you know, as our friend Ardy has noted, basically this whole idea that Palestinians, you know, should be negotiating their freedom, that somehow Israel and the Palestinians have equal rights and claims within the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That's now a settled issue. Palestinians no longer need to spend three decades negotiating their rights to water within the West Bank or where the border should be or this or that. That's all now settled international law. Similarly, if you go to the International Criminal Court, of course, the difference being that the ICC deals with individual criminal responsibility, I think it's hugely significant that not only has the ICJ determined that Israel is plausibly committing genocide, but that you have Israel's two main leaders, Netanyahu and Galant,
they're about to have arrest warrants slapped on them.
Yes.
They're not
going
to be able to travel internationally anymore.
And so, you know, law doesn't exist in a political vacuum. And in terms of these international legal institutions, they don't change anything on the ground. But they're of huge political significance. And I think we need to take the long view and see not only how they fit into a broader strategy, but how they can be put to maximum effect in such a strategy. And of course, the counterpoint here is the ICJ's 2004 advisory opinion on the West Bank Wall, which was also of huge significance. And the Palestinian leadership just basically woke up the next day as if nothing had happened and completely neglected multiple opportunities to mobilize this ruling.
So will Palestine be free from the river to the sea at any time in the foreseeable future?
I think that we're now headed for a period of exceptional instability and insecurity. And where this is all going to end up, I'm really not going to predict.
But do you have a kind of a general theory about, you know, what's going to bring all this to an end? I mean, I myself see that over time, the contradictions between what Israel is and Israel's policies and practices, and even deeper than those, what it actually is, the nature of the Jewish state, and the images that are imposed upon it, right? Its acceptance into the Western community as a way to the world and a nation amongst the nations, an American partner, that the contradictions between the two are just going to become unsustainable.
Well, if I was an Israeli leader, I would be quite concerned, and I would look at several things. You know, I've always said that Israel's primary and most important strategic asset has been the solid bipartisan consensus among U.S. political elites in support of Israel. That's begun to fracture. It's a long way from being over. But, you know, there's, you now look at the Democrats, you know, the whole Democratic National Convention notwithstanding. It bears recollection that the mainstay of U.S. support for Israel used to be not conservative Republicans, but liberal Democrats. But Israel is no longer the solid bipartisan issue of solid bipartisan consensus that it has been in recent decades in the U.S. It was that consensus, I think, that was of more strategic value to Israel than, you know, these arms deliveries or U.N. vetoes or whatever, because those were the product of the solid bipartisan consensus. I think Israel's problem, one of Israel's strengths in its early decades, was that it could be all things to all people. You know, when speaking to European social democrats, it could brag about the kibbutz, It could talk about fulfillment of biblical prophecy to evangelicals. You know, it could talk about its value as a bulwark against the Soviet Union to Cold War types and so on. The problem for Israel is that as a state and a society, it has shifted so far to the right that it can no longer do these things without violating its moral code. I mean, can you imagine someone like Ben-Gvir getting in front of an audience at the Council of Foreign Relations and saying about how much Israel wants peace? You know, someone like Shimon Peres or others, they may not have believed it, but they could convincingly go through the motions, you know, and be believed by their audience. The crew that's currently in charge, they can't even pretend without violating their own moral and political code. And so Israel has, and I think that's part of the explanation of why Israel has increasingly aligned, for example, in the U.S., not even with the Jewish community, but with, you know, right-wing evangelical Christians and kind of the MAGA wing of the Republican Party. And in Europe, I mean, Israel is a lost cause. Of course, it still has significant support in Brussels and in national governments. But that's going to change because, I mean, one thing that, you know, distinguishes many European governments from, let's say, the U.S., is where you have coalition governments, the margin of victory for gaining one or two or losing one or two more parliamentary seats is much smaller, and every vote counts. And what we're seeing now, if you look at the recent U.K. elections, Palestine is no longer the career killer. Palestine is no longer the electoral burden that it traditionally has been. Israel is no longer the electoral asset that it often has been. And so you take all these developments together, and then you look at what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, you know, regardless of our discussion about the axis of resistance, it seems that with every few passing months, you're finding someone new who has decided that they're no longer deterred by Israel and feels free to fire drones at Eilat from Yemen or from Iraq or whatever. So if I were in the Israeli leadership, I would see very serious warning signs. Having said that, there is still only one nuclear power in the Middle East. We've seen in the Gaza Strip during the past year what Israel is not only capable of doing, but also what it is willing to do, and also, just as importantly, what its allies are prepared to let it do with impunity.
And this is where the contradiction comes in. Like, at a certain point, Israel feels itself so totally free to do anything it wishes, anything it pleases. At a certain point, it's just going to become unsustainable. The contradictions between what Israel does and is and what, you know, Europe and the United States are prepared to allow it to do and are prepared to support are just going to become so great. There's going to be a tectonic shift, and suddenly, something like a bunch of countries, UK, France, Germany will, maybe not Germany. Will, acknowledge Palestinian statehood, declare that we hereby declare Palestine to be a full member state. We recognize the state of Palestine.
That's certainly
like
possible.
France doing that, and the UK doing that, the Netherlands doing it. Suddenly, there's suddenly the two tectonic plates move seismically past each other, and the situation will change.
Yeah, well, Germany definitely not. I mean, as someone recently observed, you know, Germany will defend Israeli actions as falling within the right of Israeli self-defense, even if they're talking about an Israeli attack on Germany. And the Netherlands, the way things are going, I think it's probably more likely that it would recognize Judea and Samaria as sovereign Israeli territory rather than a Palestinian state. But no, I think you raise an entirely valid point. You know, often things change very slowly or not at all, and then change very rapidly. And that's certainly potential scenario in this situation. I think the other thing we need to bear in mind is the growing polarization within Israel itself, which is, you know, has multiple dimensions. And we saw it also in the year before October 7th, which was very much focused on domestic Israeli issues and what kind of state and society Israel is or is becoming or should be, completely divorced from the Palestinians. And also, I think, an important change in Israel in the last 2 or 3 decades. You know, it's become a member of the OECD, and I think for many Israelis, particularly younger generations, their commitment to Israel is at least as much related to the opportunities that Israel provides them, as opposed to a kind of ideological commitment that was, I think, largely the case with their parents or grandparents' generation. And, you know, you can look at that two ways. On the one hand, that it increases the likelihood of Israel achieving pariah status. I mean, in my experience, the most significant criticisms of Israel in the past few decades from its Western allies were not related to anything it did in the West Bank, but about the Netanyahu's legislative agenda to overhaul the Israeli judiciary. That really got the goat for, you know, certainly in Washington and London and some other European capitals. So that's that can be one repercussion of what's happening in Israeli society. The other one is that, you know, the lunatics take over the asylum, that it's those who are most committed and most motivated to turn Israel into a kind of reflection of their own really bizarre messianic agendas, that those are the ones who are going to be in charge. And that could be a very scary reality that we are then confronted with.
Mouin Rabbani, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dutch-Palestinian writer and commentator Mouin Rabbani. Rabbani served as senior Middle East analyst and special advisor on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group and as the head of political affairs with the Office of the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria. Mouin Rabbani is co-editor of Jadalia.com. It for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now. Thank you.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. You are now